for us, there was probably two paragraphs that cost me $250,000.
Alaska air taxi operators say the IRS is making it tough to stay in business. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, February 19th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Senator Murkowski says she won't give up on the King Cove Road.
I am going to be a hellraiser on this. I'm going to channel my inner Ted Stevens, and we're going to get this road.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Alaska Premier Dental Group, offering restorative, preventive, and cosmetic dentistry with three offices, two in Anchorage and one in Wasilla. Description of services at smilealaska.com.
The state Supreme Court today reaffirmed that the Trans-Alaska Pipeline is worth $10 billion. Oil companies had argued that the pipeline should only be assessed at $850 million, and they based that number on the tariffs collected. At that lower value, the property taxes they pay to cities like Fairbanks and Valdez would be dramatically reduced. The Supreme Court found that tariff income isn't the only value derived from the pipeline. Its worth also comes from its ability to transport the billions of barrels of oil from the North Slope. While the decision only concerns the 2006 assessment, oil companies have made similar arguments over the pipeline for other tax years. Alaska's air taxi operators say the IRS has reinterpreted tax law for their industry, hitting some bush pilots with tax bills of up to $1 million. Alaska's federal lawmakers are asking the Revenue Office to back off until they get some answers about what the rules are. As APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, the unexpected burden is driving some air carriers into debt or out of business entirely.
The Alaska Air Carriers Association says the rules were written for this kind of travel.
Flight attendants, please prepare your doors for departure and cross-check.
But what if your flight is more like this? At issue is excise taxes, those sums you see on an airline ticket receipt just before the total. On an airliner, the passenger usually pays a tax of 7.5% of the price, plus $4 per flight, and the airline passes it along to the IRS. Sitka Air Service operator Scott Harris thought his Cessna 185 and de Havilland Beaver flights were exempt because the tax has an exception for small aircraft. But there's a catch, an exception to the exception. IRS publications say flights in small aircraft are taxable if they're on an established route, which the IRS defines as a route operated with some degree of regularity. Understanding or misunderstanding that term has cost Harris a pile of cash.
Some degree of regularity. This is a term that's used in the IRS world, meaning a place you go frequently, apparently.
In the summer, Harris is busy, and he does fly repeatedly to a number of destinations, a few communities, certain lodges, favorite spots for sports fishermen. He says he never imagined the excise tax applied to flights like that. Then, in 2011, he got audited. The IRS found he went to a few destinations with some degree of regularity over 3 years and hit him with a $250,000 bill. Harris says he's read the regulations and he's still astounded by the IRS interpretation.
For us, there was probably two paragraphs that cost me $250,000. And they're so vague. I don't know how anybody could read these and say, yep, going to a lodge in southeast Alaska, you got to be taxed.
He considered appealing, but the IRS said that would open him up to greater scrutiny.
So the unveiled threat to me was, yeah, sure, appeal, go ahead. And then when we come back to check it again, we're going to look at everything your float planes do, everywhere they go, how often they go there, and we're going to go back 7 years. So imagine the dollar value to that. It's insurmountable.
Soon, he says, IRS enforcement officers were calling, asking for a list of his assets. Harris says that was it for him. He took out a loan and paid the full amount.
You know, we do government work here. We do lots of things. And I can't afford to have my name out there in public as being a tax evader with a tax bill and being levied. So There was no negotiating.
The IRS responded to questions for this story by emailing links to publications on its website. Alaska's U.S. Senators and Congressman Don Young have written joint letters to the IRS for 2 years. They say they've heard of IRS agents bullying air carriers while refusing them clear guidance. In 2012, the IRS did write a memo addressing a few scenarios Bush pilots face, and it draws some interesting distinctions. It says carriers don't need to collect the tax for sightseeing on a small plane, even if they land for, say, bear viewing. But if they land to fish, the IRS says that's a taxable flight. At least it is the way many flight services sell it, by letting customers choose among several locales and offering to go every day. That, says the IRS, is some degree of regularity. Jane Dale of the Alaska Air Carriers Association says even after the 2012 memo, the regulations are too murky. Dale's group is urging the IRS to take a softer approach.
We would encourage education over audits. It would likely take less manpower by the agency. And with clear regulations, certainly groups like the Alaska Air Carriers Association would help educate and put that information out.
Jack Barber of Alaska Air Taxi on Lake Hood in Anchorage says his IRS audit 8 years ago hit like a thief in the night. He didn't have the $240,000 the service said he owed and instead filed for bankruptcy protection. Last he looked, the bill had climbed to over $800,000. Barber says the battle has cost him his financial security and, he says, his marriage.
It's about destroyed my life.
He says he still isn't sure when to collect the tax, but he's changed his business. He took down all the brochures that list his flight seeing rates, lest those be seen as a schedule. And he tries not to fly anywhere with any degree of regularity. The term itself aggravates him.
It's an overreach on the IRS's part when they want to use the term of some degree of regularity. Because that's just left of it. You know, if a comet come flying by Earth once a year, you might think that's some degree of regularity.
In a letter to Alaska's federal lawmakers in December, the acting IRS commissioner says the issue is under review. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Senator Lisa Murkowski has promised to continue fighting for a road connecting King Cove to Cold Bay. In her annual address before the state legislature today, Murkowski described the Interior Department's decision to block the project as heartless and wrong. She says it's an extreme case of federal overreach.
Now, the King Cove decision is more than a road. I think we all recognize it is more than a road. It is emblematic as to how the federal government believes that it has to somehow protect Alaska from Alaskans.
The 10-mile gravel road would run through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge, and it's long been a source of contention between the federal government and Alaska supporters of the project. King Cove residents say having a connection to a nearby airport is a matter of public safety, while the Interior Department and environmental groups believe the road would damage bird habitat and set a bad precedent for refuges. Murkowski has made construction of the road a major priority for her office. She's repeatedly called for the Interior Department to agree to a land swap that would allow for the project to go through. And last year, she escorted Interior Secretary Sally Jewell to King Cove to show her how difficult it is to medevac people from the remote community. Murkowski got applause from state lawmakers when she said she plans to keep the pressure on.
I have been told to just get past this issue. Let's just get past this issue. Let me tell you, that is not going to happen. In addition to my role as mediator and ambassador and all that, I can also be a hellraiser. And I am going to be a hellraiser on this. I'm going to channel my inner Ted Stevens, and we're going to get this road.
After her address to the legislature, Murkowski told reporters that she's thinking about putting holds on future nominations by President Barack Obama until the road issue is addressed. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a heated discussion over a proposed letter to the governor.
I believe that it is absolutely nothing less than crass and truly an embarrassment.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. It's time for the Healthy Futures Challenge. Pull out the jump ropes or go sledding with the family and get out and play. Get moving with activities the whole family enjoys. Find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. Healthy kids are happy kids. Inspire your kids to get out and play every day. For more ways to get active, visit playeveryday.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Ketchikan Gateway Borough Assembly members had a spirited discussion last night over a letter that had been submitted by two assembly members as a suggested response to Governor Sean Parnell's comments in the community last week. KRBD's Layla Carey has more.
During his visit to Ketchikan, Governor Parnell said the borough's lawsuit against the state over education funding could have repercussions for the community, specifically related to state funding for local projects. Some people interpreted that as a threat, but Parnell later told the Associated Press that he did not intend his comments to be taken that way, and he would not punish Ketchikan for its lawsuit. Despite his clarification, the proposed letter of response drafted by Assembly members Agnes Moran and Glenn Thompson strongly questioned Parnell's statements and claimed that his comments diminished the borough's trust in the state. The letter was submitted as an agenda item, which made the draft public before the full Assembly could vote on it. That was a major point of contention when the Assembly did meet to talk the issue over. Here's Assembly member Alan Bailey.
I believe that it is absolutely nothing less than crass and truly an embarrassment.
Bailey, who has not supported moving forward with the lawsuit, went on to say that the letter and how it was submitted did not serve the best interest of the community. He questioned the adversarial approach and said the governor and the state need to know that the letter does not represent the opinion of the assembly as a whole.
Therefore, I am recommending an amended motion to condemn the tone and content of this draft letter and to censure the writers of this document responsible for what I believe are actions which are not in the best interest of our community.
Assemblymember Moran was absent from the meeting, but Thompson was there. He defended the letter and the method used to propose it. He says the only way to submit such a letter is publicly because otherwise it would violate the Open Meetings Act. Thompson added that he tried to withdraw the item later because members of the public told him it was too strongly worded, not because he changed his mind.
I still stand behind what was said in the letter. I think the governor abused his power as the chief executive when he threatened retaliation against citizens exercising their constitutional rights to challenge a statute in court. I think it was an egregious abuse of power that rises to the level of tyranny, and I will not go quietly into the night, and I will not grovel before my government.
Thompson says he never expected the letter to pass an assembly vote. He just wanted to put it out there for discussion. Other assembly members noted that in the past, official responses from the assembly went through a different process, where the manager asks during a public meeting whether the assembly wants to respond and then is given direction. Here's Mayor Dave Kiefer.
The makers of the writers of this letter knew that the minute they put it in the agenda, whether that's our procedure or not, it would be out there. It wouldn't have to pass. It wouldn't have to even get any support from the room. It was out there. You could have gone and said, look, we want to respond to the governor. What do you all think?
Kiefer noted, though, that censuring Moran and Thompson seemed too strong of a response as well. Bailey agreed to remove that part of his amendment, and it eventually passed 4-2 with Thompson and Assemblymember Mike Painter voting no. Assemblymember Bill Rotecki proposed a second amendment directing the mayor to write a letter to Governor Parnell, clarifying that the draft letter in the agenda item did not reflect the opinion of the assembly. That passed 5-1 with Thompson voting no. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Layla Carey.
A Mayo Clinic study of teen smoking rates in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta region found young people there use tobacco at high rates. Nearly 30% of 11 to 14-year-olds and 63% of high school students use tobacco, compared to less than 20% of teens nationally. Dr. Christy Patton is the lead author of the YK Delta study. She says focus groups with kids in the region helped them design the intervention program, but the results were not good.
Unfortunately, the tobacco abstinence rates at the end of 6 months were not promising. Not one of the adolescents in our intervention program quit tobacco.
Were you surprised at that?
I was surprised because it was a very intensive intervention where kids stayed overnight for 2 nights, 3 days. They received counseling and fun activities, pretty much everything that they had asked for. So I figure, well, with that intensive of a program, if that did not work, we really have to take a new direction.
Do you have any insight into why do you think it didn't work?
Well, the kids came to stay in Bethel with us as counselors. But then after the weekend program, they had to go back home to their villages where their family members and many other residents are using tobacco. So it really becomes a more of a community or social issue that perhaps that level needs to be addressed in future interventions.
Are there other programs that have been successful that are that short term? It seems that if you're going to change a highly addictive behavior, it's going to take longer than a weekend intensive interaction. What other programs would compare to this?
Well, among adolescents generally, behavioral counseling, very similar to what we provided, has been the most effective treatment for youth. So we did follow evidence-based guidelines. We basically compressed the 8 hours of counseling into one weekend, however, whereas many other studies have spread it out over, say, 8 weeks. So we really did take the best evidence base for adolescents, although the quit rates for adolescent smokers involved with these types of interventions have not been that promising as well, but more promising than what we found.
What kind of feedback did you get from the teenagers, the participants?
They did talk about the struggles with going back home. During the weekend program, many did bring that up as an issue where they might potentially relapse. So I think the kids did notice or were aware that this may be an issue once they went back home.
Is there something about the sort of homemade mixture that they're using, this ICMIC, rather than commercial cigarettes, that changes the dynamic of the addiction that they're dealing with?
Well, at Mayo Clinic, we've actually analyzed this homemade mixture and found that the nicotine concentrations are much higher than, say, Copenhagen or other forms of smokeless tobacco. So there is greater addiction potential with this form of tobacco. But it is perceived as safer to use because the ash is considered a natural ingredient. So unlike commercial forms of smokeless tobacco, ICMIC, or the homemade form of smokeless tobacco, is considered to be safer.
Considered to be safer by doctors or just the community?
The community. Early on, we did focus groups of adolescents as well as adult community members. And we talked about ICMIC and their perceptions of it. And this issue came out in those focus groups that this mixture is perceived as safer to use than other forms of tobacco.
Is there any evidence that that would be true?
Well, we do have the nicotine concentration findings, which show that it has higher addiction potential. At Mayo Clinic, we actually have some studies going on where we're looking at different biomarkers associated with this ICMIC use versus other forms of tobacco. So in our work with pregnant women and kids, they have actually asked for more objective feedback on how ICMIC may be harmful to babies and teens as well as adults. So we are engaged in other research to study that issue because we don't really know for sure.
Dr. Christy Patton is the lead author of a Mayo Clinic study looking at the high rate of tobacco use among teens in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.gov. Electronic health records give doctors, nurses, and families secure access to medical information when and where it's needed most. If it's providing a new doctor access to your child's medical history or taking a loved one to the emergency room, electronic health records provide safe, secure, life-saving information on the spot. For more information, go to ak-ehealth.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services in partnership with the Alaska eHealth Network.
The Alaska Senate has unanimously passed a resolution opposing the Beringia International Park, an idea agreed upon in 1991 by then-Presidents Bush and Gorbachev. KDLG's Mike Mason has the story.
Last October, a memorandum of understanding was signed by U.S. and Russian representatives to create the Beringia International Park. The MOU is awaiting the signature of President Obama. The sponsor of Senate Joint Resolution 15 is Senator Kathy Geisel from Anchorage.
The Alaska state government has not been any part of these discussions. It's being driven by the United Nations.
The program was created in 1991 with the intent of developing and understanding the importance of the natural and cultural resources in the area known as Beringia. Senator Geisel suggests the proposed international park could cover a huge area of Alaska.
The area goes from the top of Alaska down to the Aleutian Chain and all the way over to the Mackenzie River in Canada. This, at minimum, would take in Red Dog Mine, the NPRA, Prudhoe Bay, Point Thompson, and Anwar. Camel's nose gets under the tent. National Park Service continues to expand this international designation.
Senate Joint Resolution 15 asks that the Alaska Legislature and Congress give their approval before any further designation or actions are taken regarding the Beringia International Park. The park would include parts of the district represented by Senator Donnie Olson, who spoke out in support of the resolution during Tuesday's Senate floor session.
There's no doubt that the commonality of culture and language, tradition, exist between the peoples on both sides of the Bering Straits. But I am wary of an international park that can stifle development, economic growth in the region of Alaska that I represent. As part of the park that's there now, what I've seen the influence of is that's cramped the efforts of the reindeer herding industry. Those people that are dependent on herding those animals for the last over 100 years have been put on the back burner because of this park that has already there. This will further, I think, thwart some of the efforts of people that are just trying to maintain a living out there, just trying to go ahead and live so they can stay back where their families are from.
Senate Joint Resolution 15 calls for the Alaska governor and the agencies of the state to be consulted and involved in the process of designating the proposed Beringia International Park if a decision is made to go forward. The resolution also includes language calling for the governor and the attorney general to use all legal remedies available if the creation of the park would hamper the use or development of the natural resources of the state of Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Mike Mason.
Juneau child care workers are getting paid more and staying in their jobs longer than they were just a few years ago. That's according to an organization that runs a pilot program designed to improve access to child care in the capital city. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more about how the program works.
One, two, three, and the very top one.
Deputy City Clerk Beth McEwen helps a group of kids from Discovery Preschool put Valentine's Day cards in Juneau Assembly members' mailboxes. The cards were handcrafted by preschoolers from across the city to thank the assembly for funding the Hearts Initiative.
Oh, yes. Oh, and its crane goes right there.
Hearts stands for Hiring, Educating, and Retaining Teaching Staff. Joy Lyon is executive director of the Southeast Alaska Association for the Education of Young Children, which runs the program.
The Hearts Initiative offers incentives and encouragement for child care providers to pursue their education so they can become better teachers, and it also encourages them to stay in their positions and be able to afford to work with the children that they love.
When the Valley Youth Club closed in 2010, several groups came to the assembly and urged members to address gaps in the city's child care services. The assembly made the issue a top priority and provided about $92,000 in funding for the Hearts Initiative in each of the past 2 years.
We're seeing some remarkable results.
The program reimburses child care professionals for university classes and other training in early childhood education. Workers can also qualify for wage incentives up to $2.71 an hour for employees with a 4-year degree. Before Hearts, Lyon says child care centers in Juneau were struggling to stay open. Only one out of every 7 workers met state standards, and turnover was close to 100%. Today, Lyon says there's 1 qualified staff for every 4 child care workers, and the turnover rate is 67%.
So they're really staying. Once they reach that level of education, they have this awareness of how important they are to the lives of young children and families. And they see that there's some incentive and some recognition from the city of how valuable they are.
Assemblywoman Karen Crane chairs the Juneau Assembly Finance Committee, which will soon tackle the city's biennial budget process. While she can't guarantee funding for HEARTS in the next two-year budget, Crane says she's encouraged by the apparent success of the program.
The entire assembly is aware of the fact that finding child care in Juneau is hard. There are not enough child care providers. So seeing results from this is very gratifying.
Oh, it's snowing! Good to see you!
The kids at Discovery Preschool are getting ready to head out into the snow. Teacher's assistant Christine Amor helps the little ones put on their jackets and hats. Amor already has an associate's degree in early childhood education, as well as a bachelor's degree in environmental studies. After this month, she'll qualify for a wage incentive through HEARTS.
Being an educator, you're always concerned about the fact that you put all this time and effort and love into your work, but you know, you don't really get great money.
Of course, Amor says she's not in it for the money, but because of the relationships she has with the kids.
But the incentive is very nice, and I think it does encourage a lot of people to continue working in the field.
Lyon says the next step is getting more people to open childcare facilities in Juneau.
Stabilizing the current programs is the first priority. And then, yes, we have some new family child care providers that started their business because they heard of the HEARTS initiative.
She says Juneau's 38 child care facilities have space for less than one in five children under the age of five in the capital city. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Mike Mason in Dillingham, and Casey Kelly in Juneau. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau, and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying Alaska dealers with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser heaters for more than 26 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com. BP Alaska, as part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2014 PFD. Paper applications are located in your community. More information at pfd.alaska.gov or on Facebook. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, gives Alaska Native students the inspiration and opportunity to excel in science and engineering careers, building a sustainable future for Alaska. More at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by ANSEP.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.